Hey, I'm Dalton Ross, and welcome to the EW Morning Live podcast, where we bring you the best TV and movie interviews from our Entertainment Weekly morning show on Sirius XM. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at EWML Podcast, and get a little taste of what we offer every day on Sirius XM channel 105. With that said, now there's nothing to it but to get to it, so sit back and enjoy this week's edition of the EW Morning Live podcast.
This is EW Morning Live with Dalton Ross and Jessica Shaw on Entertainment Weekly Radio.
Welcome back to EW Morning Live. Dalton Ross here with you. Very excited for our next guest. You know him from favorite movies and TV shows. He's taking the stage tonight at Feinstein's 54 Below right here in New York City for Shelter in Concert. There's two shows you can go to actually tonight at 7 or 9:30. So if you're in the New York area, definitely make sure to check it out. It's John Cryer here in studio. How's it
going,
man?
That's me, John Cryer.
That's
who's
you!
Who's in all your favorite movies. If you like Star Wars, I'm in that. I'm actually not.
We could digitally put you in that,
exactly.
Right?
We could. And we should. I think that if there's anybody out on the internet who could just Photoshop me into all the great films, you know, Godfather, you know, just hit them all, that would be awesome.
Touching all the bases.
Yes.
Let's talk about this show tonight that you're doing. This is kind of fascinating because this is a show written by your mother, right?
Yes.
Over 40 years ago,
40 years
right?
ago, yes. First of all, musical theater geeks are a special breed. They have long memories, and there's a series called the Second Act series that they put on at Feinstein's, which, theater geeks are insane about. And it's where they take shows that had unjustifiably short runs and give them a new chance to be out there in front of people in a concert setting. It's really fun. And my mom has written a lot of successful off-Broadway shows, but the only show of hers that ever made it to Broadway was a show called Shelter. My mom's Gretchen Cryer, and it was interesting. It was kind of before its time. Because it was about a guy who is a commercial producer, but he lives in his studio because he's afraid to leave. And he's got his home personal computer that he talks to that controls his whole life and gives him day and night inside this studio where he completely makes his own reality. And in 1973, having a computer that talked to you was nuts. Now it's every day. The show is actually almost more relevant than it was then.
Yeah.
And it's been it's great for me. It's weird because I saw the show when I was 7 years old.
Wow!
And this guy has sort of arranged he's having an affair on his wife, and and at the time, I didn't understand it at 7 years old. I was like, why is she so mad that he's having girls over? Everybody can bring their friends over. You know, that didn't bother me at all. But I now have a more nuanced understanding of it as a grown-up. But it's been absolutely fascinating.
How did it come about bringing this back? I mean, you mentioned the series, I know, that Feinstein's does, but how did they get in touch with you or your mom, and like how did this all come together, bringing Shelter back 4 years later?
Right? That is a very good question, actually. For me, it just came out because my mom called me and said, hey, you want to do it? And, you know, your mom calls you and says, hey, you want to do my show? It's like, yeah, of course, Mom. But my understanding was that Steve McCaslin, who runs the thing, contacted my mom and said, hey, you know, nobody's done the show in a long time. Let's give it a try. It's so funny because you put your heart and soul into the work you're doing. Yeah. But then once you move on, you kind of move on. And I don't know that she'd thought about it in a long time, thought about, you know, putting it out there again. And it's been such a lovely surprise seeing how relevant it is for today.
It's interesting because it only lasted, 31 performances back in 1973. You mentioned you saw it when you were 7 years old, but when she asked you to do it, did you have to sort of call it, wait, what show is that? Or like, I don't even really remember what happened in that.
I remember because we had a poster on the wall. That was my complete memory of it. Oh, and there was one moment in it where the guy has a plastic tree in his house, and one of the women who's angry at him cuts it down. I remember that. that was etched in my memory. But that was, you know, my memories were vague at best. And it's been fascinating to try and find who my character is when I really didn't know the show. You know, right. And also when the stakes are kind of high just for me because I want to make my mom happy.
Yeah, right.
It's like the last thing I want my mom to do is say, "You suck, sweetie. Just, I love you dearly, but you blew this.
You're such a disappointment."
I know, exactly.
Take everyone's fear. Well, what about, you said, because it's presented in like a concert setting. Tell me about approaching the singing for this, and how daunting is that?
It's a little scary for me because I have done musicals. I did Company at Lincoln Center a few years ago, and I can sing, but I wouldn't say it's my lane. But you know, and I had a weird thing happen where I had a weird stomach problem a year ago, and it ravaged my vocal cords, which is a thing that people who sing professionally have to worry about. But I didn't sing professionally, so I was like, yeah, whatever, big deal. But then my mom asked me to do this. I was like, oh, no, I have to get my vocal cords back in shape. And it turns out the thing that's been ravaging my vocal cords is drinking an enormous amount of coffee. So I had to quit coffee, which I had about 2 weeks of the worst headaches that I have ever experienced. And I'm going back on coffee the day after I finish this show. I'm just telling you that, people. I cannot wait.
What you don't see is right as he's telling that story, someone came in the studio and brought him some tea.
It brought me some tea, exactly. I am no fool. And I could not say thank you because I was on the air and I didn't want to.
That's right. You gave, like, there was a nod. I fear there was an acknowledgement, of the tea.
Thank you,
delivery.
Helpful person. Who was? I don't know what their name is.
I don't even know.
Oh,
what
great!
Their name
okay,
was. It's missed. They're in. They're out.
Anonymous minion.
Was that person ever even here? Like the tea just arrived out of nowhere.
Do they exist? And it's hot. Holy crud!
Yeah,
wow.
Don't burn anything. Now you got two performances tonight. You got to do. So you better make sure it's on lockdown.
You're right.
And it's interesting, Jump, because usually when you're going to do any sort of, you know, theater or concert like this, you know, maybe it's going to run. You're going to do this for a few months, or maybe it's a limited engagement you're going to do for a month or a few weeks. This is one night. This is two shows. How much work have you put in for this for just one night?
It's actually only been about 3 or 4 days of rehearsal. But I got the music a month ago, and I went to a vocal coach, and he's the one who said, by the way, cut the coffee out.
Yeah.
So I've been working on it for about a month on the music, and now. Now we're working on getting the play to work, and I'm, you know, just trying to find it. Literally, I'm leaving here to go to another rehearsal, and we're putting everything together, and you know, it's going to be a great show.
We're talking with John Cryer, who's performing a Shelter in concert tonight here at Feinstein's 54 Below here in New York City. There's shows at 7 and 9:30, and what I got to know is, do you know yet where your mother will be seated? Like, are you going to, like, look at her or avoid eye contact with her at all costs that she wrote this thing?
This one's for you, mommy. You know, yes, I will know where she's seating. Also because she has a wonderful, generous laugh. So I'm sure I will hear that. Hopefully I will hear that, unless it's a laugh of derision. She's like laughing, wow, you blew this, honey. If it's that, then... but I will know where she is.
Yeah, because, listen, Fit for Flow is a great space. There'll be a lot of people there, but it is an audience of one that you're playing to, right?
Exactly.
You're playing
That's
to your mom.
That's all I care about, folks. That's all I care about, mama.
Obviously, John, people know they saw you on Two and a Half Men for so many years. Episodic television is a grind. I mean, it's a grind. You did, well, I think, like 262 episodes of that over 12 seasons. Throw in the fact there was a little bit of drama in there from time to time.
Just a little bit.
But I mean, do you ever look back on that and think, how did I do that week in, week out? Because of episodic television, that is a marathon, not a sprint.
That's true. Well, you know, it's a marathon you don't know you're doing. That's the problem, is that you show up and you don't know if you've got another season most of the time. In our case, Two and a Half Men as a workload was a dream job, because we had fantastic writers who didn't do a huge amount of rewriting. Doing a sitcom, doing a multi-camera sitcom, you know, with a studio audience and stuff like that, is way less work than shooting, say, you know, a CSI or a Law and Order, or, right, so, you know, shooting a drama. You know, so in many respects, it's a dream job. It's a job that actors just vie for and, you know, are hoping their whole lives to get. But, you know, of course, there's moments where you feel like, oh, this is, you know, and usually, and when your co-star goes insane and gets fired, those are one of those moments where you feel like, you know, this job is hard sometimes. but I'm still incredibly grateful for the experience, and it lasted for 12 years, and they were 12 great, great, great years of my life, and I'm happy that the show stuck around, that it's on TV nonstop still.
You said something really interesting there, too, because I've talked to a lot of actors who will say either, you know, on air or sort of, you know, off air, off to the side or off the record, they're like, oh, my God, like, you know, rewrites constantly, and we do these sides, and we think we have them ready, and then all of a sudden, like, everything's changed at the last minute. And what you said about Two and a Half Men is that at least was kept to a minimum, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And if you were ever uncomfortable about it, the writers were great about changing stuff and working on stuff. That was one of the reasons that the blow up was so crazy, was because all you had to do was ask.
Right.
you know? The thing about rewrites, though, is it does make it harder, but that's the gig, folks. You know, you don't get into this business because everything's always going to be easy. You know, I just shot a pilot for ABC a while ago. It did not go. But we got a fair amount of rewrites, but that's the job. You know, right. you gotta get those rewrites. Hopefully they'll give you enough time to learn them. But you've got to learn them. That's why you get the big bucks.
And it's amazing about getting the big bucks and all that, because you've been on both sides of that. You just mentioned the show that you just didn't get picked up. You had shows before that either didn't get or ran or very short-lived shows. Mm-hmm. And some shows, they got very good critical reviews but just couldn't find the audience. So when you got that, and when lightning did strike and you had that big hit, I know that you must have appreciated it that much more.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, there's nothing. Failure makes success so much better. It really does. And the thing is, you know, there's things that you consider as a failure, that a lot of people would consider huge successes, just getting a show on the air. Yeah. You know, even though, like, I did several shows that lasted, you know, a season, and were considered failures, that I loved doing them, you know. So, and I was happy with them. I was happy with how they came out. So, you know, when you're an actor, it's like that's all you can hope for. Really, like this pilot I did for ABC, yeah. it did not get picked up, but I was so happy with it. I was like, okay, I can move on with my life. We did the thing we wanted to do, and that's really, really satisfying. What drives you crazy is when either you suck or or the thing didn't gel together, or something that you read that was really fun to read ends up stupid on screen, and it happens. Oh my gosh, it happens. You know, I did a movie called Superman 4. Superman. It's like, it's Christopher Reeve. They got the whole band back together. They got Margot Kidder. They got all the cool people. They got Gene Hackman. Oh, that movie sucked. Oh my gosh, it sucked. And I was one of the main reasons it sucked. And and so those kind of things are hard to deal with. And those are the things that you consider failures. You know, the things where you didn't do what you wanted to do.
The quest for peace.
Yes. God, wow. You remember
of
it.
Of course I remember.
Gosh.
How could I forget? You know what else I remember?
Good.
You know what
he else came
I
to play.
I do. Well, you know what else I remember, John? I remember your facial hair in Hiding Out. Can we talk about the facial hair in Hiding Out at the beginning of that movie?
Yes, course we could talk about the facial hair. That was a beard. That was a fake beard. Even though I now have a luxurious Grizzly Adams style beard. At the time we had to fake it because it was kind of patchy on me because I was like 24 years old.
Yeah.
And it was the most horrifying, annoying thing for an actor, because you act with your face. It's what you use. Yeah. And so when you have a thing glued to half your face, it kind of limits you. And the glue they used to use was stuff called spirit gum. And I don't know if you guys have ever done community theater, but anytime you're trying to stick something on your face, you use spirit gum, and it burns. It burns. And I had to wear the beard for like a month of shooting. And it was a nightmare. It was absolutely a nightmare. And it looked goofy on screen. And then I had the crazy hair at the end of the show because of the dye job that goes wrong, and oh, it was a nightmare. That being said, but like hiding out was a good experience for me because I was a producer on that show, and and shepherded through the writing process, and I have a lot of affection for that movie.
I do too. I was right at that age. I was a teenager, and like I remember that movie, seeing it right when it came out, without a doubt. And I also, of course, we're going to talk Pretty in Pink, because my question for you about Pretty in Pink is, how do you feel about the ending? Because we know they had a different ending that ends very differently, and the legend that they had the test screening or whatever, they changed it. Should Andy have picked Ducky?
In the end, I think no. I do think the movie is best as it is, because I think you really do invest in that relationship. I also am just, I've rewatched the movie fairly recently, and realized that a lot of people thought Ducky was gay, and that was total news to me as a person who does not happen to be gay and did not intend for that flavor to be in there. They sort of, and even Molly herself thought of Ducky as her gay best friend, and I was like, wow, I didn't think of that. and to some members of the gay community, he's kind of an icon, and it's like, great, more power to them. But it was interesting to reassess the movie in light of that, and but I also think, you really do invest. I mean, just watching it as a viewer, you invest in that. At the time, I was annoyed because I wanted to be the guy who got the girl. And when I got, when they told me we were doing reshoots, it wasn't until I got to L.A. I was shooting another film at the time, and they flew me back to L.A. It wasn't until then that I got the sides, and they told me, oh, yeah, by the way, your character's not getting the girl anymore. And I was like, okay. I was very stoic at the time. But again, that's the gig. You gotta get involved with people you trust and actually trust them.
I wonder if different people are watching and wanting a different thing. You know what I mean? For the female perspective, and that's the question she's on for Blaine, and you want her to achieve that. For the misfit loser guy, teenager watching that movie, I'm pointing at myself. you want to hit one on the chalkboard for us. You know what I mean?
Yes, I agree. And the thing was, again, the gay thing was interesting to me because I was a kind of an effeminate kid, even though I was straight. I was an effeminate heterosexual dork, and I was hoping for one for the effeminate heterosexual dorks out there. Not necessarily you, but
no, that was me. Trust me.
But again, I'm glad that people bought into it that way. I'm glad that they wanted that to happen. A lot of people feel it's like an historic injustice along the lines of the massacres in Serbia or whatever. But it is not that.
Right.
It's just a movie, folks. I don't know. I'm happy with the way it came out. I love the movie. The movie holds up great. And
it really does. It's fun because I have a teenage girl. It's fun showing it to her now, and it still is timeless in that way. They still love those old John Hughes movies.
Yes,
great.
Breakfast Club holds up great. It's remarkable.
Do you just break into a cold sweat when like you're out or in your car, someone you hear Try a Little Tenderness come on? Like, is it just sort of like, does your whole body just like, what happens there?
A smile sort of creeps across my face. But what's funny is people equate me with the song. All I did was lip sync it. I have no right to that song other than a very emotionally invested in performance of a lip sync. I interestingly, If You Leave, the OMD song always gets me. Whenever I hear that song, I just, a tear comes to my eye. But that all the there was so much great music in that, and because that's what John Hughes did. He put together soundtracks and it was great to be a part of that.
Am I making this up that Kenny Ortega helped choreograph your lip syncing scene?
You are not making that up.
If it was
a guess, it's a very lucky guess.
I thought I remember that because I talked to him once, and I thought that came
up. Yeah. I mean, when you look back on his career, he's done some pretty remarkable stuff. But yeah, the director got me in touch with him literally the night before we were supposed to start shooting it. And he and I sort of threw it together. He knew I'm not in any way a trained dancer, but he just wanted to take advantage of what I could do. And he's lovely and has this great attitude. I don't know if you've ever, well, you talked to him, obviously.
Yeah.
And he just made it really fun, and he really got what the emotion of it was. And so I, but it was funny because the director wasn't expecting something so elaborate. And so when I showed it to him, he was not happy. And I thought, you know, we worked so hard on this, and I can't believe you're not happy about this. He's like, no, the thing is great. The problem is I have to shoot it, which meant that it put him behind schedule. He took, you know, they had maybe a half day scheduled to shoot that whole thing. And he said, no, this is going to take a day easy. You know, it put it, and he was a first time director, a guy named Howie Deutsch. And so, you know, it was going to put him behind the eight ball for the rest of the shoot. But he did it.
It was worth it. And did you have any inkling at the time that that was going to become really an iconic scene for a lot of people? I mean,
No, I thought it was fun. It was, you know, it was it, when I read the script, there was just, it was just two lines. It was like Ducky comes in singing a song, making a big deal of it. And then it went into the scene, which is as it should be. But I thought, oh, okay, if I'm supposed to make a big deal of it, I will. And so we ran with it.
All right. So, John, before we let you go, as we mentioned, you got Shelter in concert tonight here at 54 Below. To give anyone in the New York area, tell them why they need to come see you. You gave up coffee for weeks to do this show tonight. Why should they come see you?
2 weeks of horrifying headaches has to pay off in some way. But this is the only night you can see it.
That's true.
One night only, folks. This is the only night you can see this show. It's great. The music is fantastic. I had forgotten how beautiful the music was. It's funny and it's relevant, and it got great reviews. It's a tragedy that it did not run for ages on Broadway.
Well, maybe you can sit next to John Cryer's mother, Gretchen, in the audience and see what she thinks of it. Two shows tonight at 7 and 9:30. John Cryer, thanks for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Thank you guys so much.
Check out Shelter in concert tonight at 54 Below Feinstein's. We'll be back with more on EW Morning Live. Like I need you then. You always said we'd still be friends someday. If you leave, I won't cry. I won't waste one single day.
This is EW Morning Live with Dalton Ross and Jessica Shaw on Entertainment Weekly Radio.
Welcome back to EW Morning Live. Dalton and Amy here with you on Entertainment Weekly Radio. Pretty pumped up for our next guest. You've seen her on Saturday Night Live and Girls, and she's starring in a really great movie right now as well. But she also has a new show on Amazon Prime that comes out this Friday, I believe, June 30th. Danger and Eggs. She's AD Bryant. She's here in studio. What's going on, AD?
Oh, hello.
Baby.
How you doing?
AD. Yes. Thank you for calling me by my legal name.
Right, exactly. That's what's on your birth certificate.
Yes.
Interesting. You voiced the this show Danger and Eggs. You voiced the character of Dee Dee Danger, which I find fascinating because Danger is my middle name.
Whoa.
No,
it's
and
not.
Eggs there's
nothing,
is there's my no, middle name.
There's nothing dangerous about me, actually, at all, sitting here in a radio studio. But tell us, how did you get involved with this, AD?
Yeah, so, I mean, really, they just sent me the script, and I was like, I love this so much. And I knew I was going to have to do it at the same time as SNL, so I was like, I have to really like this because it's going to be such long hours. But I just loved it. I mean, it's really cool. It's like sort of a badass girl character for kids, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And she's just bold and like unafraid, and she's doing her own thing, and her best friend is a giant talking egg. Who keeps her safe?
it's what's funny about the show is that the egg Philip is. He's a nervous Nelly. Let me just tell you right now, this guy's worried about getting, and he's an egg. He could get cracked. Let's be honest. That's an issue. But I love the fact that, like you said, like you're this kind of like really sort of daredevil character, and then he's just sort of like basically the person like running after you, trying to make sure that, you know, everything stays in one piece.
That's exactly right.
I love to, you, I mean, we know you from SNL, we know you from Girls. This is obviously another side of your abilities because your voice is so jubilant and so lovely on this show. Does
Thank
that take
you?
Well, you're welcome. I'm here for you. But is that sort of like a different muscle you're exercising when you get in the booth and you're doing these voices? Because it almost feels like it must be like an aerobic workout.
Yeah, you know, I went into it being like, oh, this is going to be a breeze. I'll just wear no makeup, wear my pajamas, roll in and just like chill out and be on the mic. And then like almost every scene, they're like, okay, she's jumping off the top of a water slide and she does six flips and you don't have your eyes and body and face to like show that. So you really do have to like fully go above and beyond 150% with your voice, which is, I'm sure you guys know, it's like you're trying to convey energy and all these things. And so, yeah, it was like, it was a new thing for me, but I loved it. I really did. And also they were so nice and like would let me improvise on the mic. And so I would just be in the booth making insane noises for 10 minutes straight. And then I was like, this is a job. This is a job.
You're giving me money to do
this.
Do you record with your co-stars in the booth too? Or are you
I'm all alone.
That's crazy to me.
I know, it's weird. It is weird, but it's kind of cool.
How did you find the voice of Dee Dee? How do you like decide on, because you're playing, you know, a young girl, like how did it take you a while to settle on that, or did you just sort of find it pretty instantly?
Yeah, so the creators of the show and I, like the first session, we tried like a bunch of different things and this was kind of where we landed because it just felt young and excited and like, I don't know, it just worked out. So yeah, we tried a lot, but I like where we landed. It feels real, kind of, you know, totally. Like a kid having fun.
What do you, because as we mentioned, basically the character, your character is sort of a bit of a thrill seeker and Philip's very sort of nervous and cautious. Which character are you more like in real life? Are you the thrill seeker or are you sort of the...
I'm the egg.
You're the egg? Yeah. I think I'm the
egg too. Full-time egg. Yeah, so cautious, so afraid.
I think I want to be Dee Dee, but
that's
I'm really
same.
Philip. That's the thing, right?
That's same with me.
Yeah.
I want to be Dee Dee, and so I'm trying to be Dee Dee.
What are you doing to be Dee Dee?
Nothing.
No. Well, I feel like living in New York, there's always like that bucket list of stuff you should be doing. And I feel like I'm never doing the exciting stuff.
What's on
like,
the bucket list?
Well, you know, like it's all that like Sex and the City junk. It's like go do the trapeze at Chelsea's Pier.
I know, or like eat a hamburger that's made of noodles or something. And like
exactly.
I feel like I'm always like, yeah, I need to do that stuff.
There's like too many options. It becomes overwhelming at a certain point. Like you have that bucket list, but then you just end up doing nothing on it because
really
there's too
right.
much.
I know. That's true.
Adi, what was it like going... Amazon's got a very interesting situation where they put it up an episode and then fans vote and rate and you know, see what watch it and then you find out. So you kind of play the waiting game. I guess with any show to a degree, you're playing the waiting game to see if it gets picked up. But Amazon, like this came out, I think episode one came out in like 2015.
Yeah.
And now, you know, we're in 2017 in summer and we're finally seeing the rest of the... So what was that whole process like?
I mean, it's weird because I think... And normally the pilot process is like a nerve-wracking thing. I was so confident and so cocky in the show. I loved it so much. And I just thought it was so cool. And, you know, the creators of the show also worked on Yo Gabba Gabba, which is like the coolest for kids and adults. And I really feel that way about this show. And so, because it's like a fast-paced show with real comedy that adults can enjoy with while they watch with their kids. And so... To me, I like went into the process fully. I was like, they got to pick this up. They'd be dummies not to. I was like, they got us. So I don't know. I mean, you're right. It is like a weird long process to like, you know, I recorded a lot of the stuff like almost a year ago now, but the animation takes so long and it's, but I just think it's like worth the wait and it's been such a cool process. So
was there one of those things where you campaigned with like your family and your friends and you're like, tell Amazon that you like this pilot because that'll keep me in a job.
Yeah. Everyone who's close to me hates me.
So. So when you first recorded the vocals, did you have an idea of what your character would look like or did you come into that so early on that there wasn't even like a fully fleshed out?
No, they had like renderings of stuff and they had kind of like examples of like, it was really helpful to see just because I was like, oh, you can imagine how like colorful this world is and how energetic this person is. And I knew kind of what Philip the Egg's deal was. And so that it did really help to check it out. But it was weird. I had never experienced where like so much of the stuff is action that you're like putting noise to, but you can't see the action. Mm-hmm. So they are, I mean, these people who made this show are really good at describing what's happening, where they're like, okay, she's riding on the back of a dog and then 200 other dogs come. And, you know, like you have to imagine right, all yeah. this stuff yeah. and kind of make sounds that correlate. Well,
that's what I always wonder yeah. about with animation, because it's not just the lines, it's like ah, ooh, da, blah, or whatever.
Which like, is so, like, to me, I'm like, oh, I guess there's three sounds which are like, huh, ee. Like, I can't, and so they were really good about giving me, like, you know, try putting, like, a P in front of that sound, yeah, or, like, you know, awesome. Make, like, a sucking noise, or whatever. I would be like, okay.
And then that becomes your reel, right? When you're going out for other jobs, you're like, listen to how well I can suck.
That's right. I do all my little sounds for them.
We're talking with A.D. Bryan, whose new show, Danger and Eggs, is available on Amazon Prime this Friday, June 30th. And it's interesting how you mentioned how you'd be doing this while you're doing SNL. I was going to ask you about that in terms of other work. How much can you do when you're in season, or how much do you have to wait till you're on hiatus?
It depends, you know, certain like I also did Horace and Pete yeah. with Louis C.K. I did that at the same time as at SNL. And it just depends. Like, it's so much of it is how much whatever the other place is willing to work around SNL's insane schedule. Because SNL, there's like almost no flex with it. And you can't be right. like, sorry, guys, I'm going to miss a day. Because then you're like, oh, my gosh, I'm 10 years behind everyone else on the changes and right. blocking stuff. So you can't miss. But yeah, so mostly you work around your hiatuses, but then, you know, you SNL, because we work so late, often doesn't start till closer to 1 p.m. Mm. Right. So there's time in the morning, but it's also like you've worked until 3 in the morning. Right. And then if you start at 7 a.m., you're like, oh, I'm a zombie person now. But it's worth it, you know, if you can squeeze in extra stuff that you care about.
Is the schedule such that the end of your week is more packed than the beginning? Is there kind of like a ramp up period with SNL, or are you kind of on high alert the entire week while you're doing it?
It's weird because basically Monday is our only like light day, because mm-hmm. We just pitch the host and that's like maybe an hour and a half, you know? Okay. And then you kind of are meeting with writers and stuff. But basically from Tuesday to Saturday, it's like a house on fire with everyone running. Like, it never stops, and it's fully insane top to bottom. Yeah. So I wish there was more of a ramp up, but it just basically Tuesday you wake up and you're like, the hell begins, here we go.
What's it, I mean, obviously with any job you have, people are coming and going. What's it been like on Saturday Night Live? Because obviously they have a lot of high profile exits, and that means that there's other new people coming in that you haven't worked with, and you build up rapport with people, and you know beats and chemistry and timing, and then you have new people coming in. Like, what's that whole process like for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's like bittersweet, but I'm also, you know, all the people who are leaving are brilliant and are going to go on to do such great things. I'm like actually so excited for them. And as far as new people coming in, I actually love when new people come in, because it reminds you, not that I'm used to it at all, but I just remember my first year arriving and being like, I cannot believe I get to be any part of this insane thing. I came straight from Chicago. I was like, all of a sudden I'm like hobnobbing and hanging out and like I'm on Saturday Night Live. And it's almost like you, like, even the opening musical credits of the like iconic SNL theme song, you like hear it new again when you're with the new people, because they get so choked up about being in their first opening credits, and you're like, oh man, this is like, it's just a nice reminder when new people come in how special the job is, mm-hmm. and how much it changed my life, and so it's always fun to talk to them about like you made it here and your life will never be the same, and it's just a cool. I like when new people come in.
I mean, you got to Saturday Night Live so quickly. I mean, I feel it was just like, what, 2-3 years after you graduated, like college. Like,
yeah,
you're there on
Saturday. I was 25.
Yeah, you're like on Saturday Night Live. Or, I mean, I always find it fascinating. Do you ever think about that? Like, wow, connect the dots of how I got from here to there. And wow, if I just done this one thing, or if I hadn't done this, or if I hadn't been at this place on this one night, and like how everything could be different.
Oh, I think about it all the time, because even, I mean, I was performing at Second City and I was doing a show, and I mean, often you had to like call out sick or that kind of thing, or you would miss a week because you're on vacation or something. And it, you know, Lorne Michaels came one night, you know,
that's so crazy.
And what if I wouldn't have been there, yeah. or something? Who would have known? And, you know, the other thing that I feel really lucky about for me was Lorne saw me perform in a 2-hour show. Mm. And And so you really get to see like a full performance, you know, that night. There were six other people in the show, but it's like he saw me for 2 hours. A lot of people when they, you know, and then I got to audition and bring my best 5 minutes and whatever. Right. But a lot of people when they come from just sending a tape in or whatever, they get 5 minutes. That's all you get to show. Yeah. And I got to be in front of an audience of 350 people, you know, so in a way I'm like, I cheated.
Yeah, right.
I cheated.
So you had a laugh track. You had a laugh track
when
you auditioned.
That's right. I know.
You mentioned Chicago, though, and I want to go on just a tiny tangent.
Please.
I need to know Giordano's versus Lumonati.
Wow.
Where do you fall?
I'm going to really blow your mind and say Gino's East.
I know so many Gino's East people. So I went to Northwestern for
really?
A year. So I only got to do the slight taste of Chicago.
Okay.
But I never made it to Gino's East. And now when I ask people their pizza preference, I hear that a lot.
Really?
What is it about the Gino's East that really gets you?
Now, I shouldn't act like a snob because I would eat any one of those three places.
They're all
right
great.
Now.
Is this deep dish we're talking about?
Yes. Okay. This is Chicago deep dish. Okay.
But I don't know. I think Gino's East, I had it the most when I was in college. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's like a sense memory where I'm
sure.
like, I'm young and wild and free again, having some deep dish pizza. But yeah, it's all good.
I can't go wrong. I went and visited Chicago about a year ago, and it'd been about a decade since I've been there. And I had Giordano's, and I realized that is a young person's game.
Yeah, it truly is.
I deep dishes. Felt so terrible the next day. I'm also lactose intolerant.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It was
that.
Just a lot of bad decisions wrapped into one. But I was like, never again.
Pizza
like,
often
the
is.
Deep dish yeah. might be just off the menu for me now.
That's fair.
Adia, you know, you're in The Big Sick, which just came out.
Yeah.
And it was just is in limited release now. It's getting wider. I haven't had a chance to see it yet because I've been away. But everyone I've talked to is in love with this movie.
Whoa, that's so
I'm
nice.
I'm hearing like such great things about this film. What can you say about being a part of that?
I mean, it has been like the joy of my life. It really is. I mean, also just knowing Kumail Nanjiani, and he is a genius, and his wife Emily is brilliant, and they wrote this movie together about their true life love story, and I don't know. It also feels, and this feels lame to say maybe, but like in 2017, it feels very revolutionary to have like a Pakistani hunk in this film.
Sure.
Like you fully are like, this is the hunk star of this film. And you get to learn about his family and their experience with arranged marriages. And it feels like, oh, I've never seen this movie before at all, you know? And I feel like in a rom-com space, that's not always true. You know, you're
yeah.
like, oh, I've kind of seen this movie.
And there have been so few what I would call really great rom-coms
totally.
Over the last few years. It's almost a bit of a dying genre. So to have it resurge in this way with such a lovely film is so
yeah.
exciting.
And I also think there's like, it's such a like all-star cast in
yeah.
that like every single person just gives a killer performance. Zoe Kazan, Ray Romano, Holly Hunter, they like kill it, you know, in a way that is so emotional but so funny, and it's just really great. So I'm a very teeny part of the film. I just play one of Kumail's friends, but it's been such a joyful thing to get to like go to all these events with them, and we did a stand-up tour to promote it, and it's just been so much fun. I cannot recommend it enough.
Yeah.
I know that sounds like braggy because I'm
no,
in it, but I
that's what everyone's saying.
It really
me.
Is
yeah.
like it's just such a delight to watch. It really is.
Have you known Kumail for a while now, or did you guys kind
just
of
a couple years? Sorry, I like took an insane breath and almost died just at the idea of like knowing him. But yeah, no, we've known each other a couple of years.
Okay.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, we also saw you near the end of Girls. And I think it's actually so funny that, you know, we met you as Shoshana's boss at,
yeah.
at one point, right? And then you kind of came full circle and ended up being this really lovely love interest for Ray. Did you realize or know ahead of time that your character was going to kind of swoop back in and actually play kind of a pivotal role near the end?
Not at all. I had no idea. I mean, I knew after, let's so we shot in Japan,
mm-hmm.
which was
those
the coolest thing
were
I've
so
ever.
Fun.
Oh my
like,
god!
Like beautiful,
amazing,
culture. Yeah,
truly cool. Also, like if you can ever go to Japan, you should.
Go
right,
to
it's
Japan.
Like
sure.
so amazing. But so yeah, shooting in Tokyo was like the most insane experience of my life, and we had so much fun while I was there. That they had said like, oh, we'd love to bring you back, but I figured, you know, maybe just for like a Skype call or something, you know, not
right.
not
right,
like
yeah.
a full thing. And so, yeah, it was such a nice surprise. And you know, I also, at least personally, I'm rarely offered the love interest role. And so I was very like touched and honored and appreciative to be given that chance to do that.
Right.
And especially on this show that I watched when I lived in Chicago before I had ever been on TV, and I loved it and it felt revolutionary to me back then. So to be a part of its ending was totally felt like an emotional, like full circle moment for me that I like couldn't handle kind of.
What do you think the future is for Ray and Abigail?
Yeah, you think like, they're still together? What do you think is going on there?
Ooh, I think they're together forever.
Yeah, there's riding carousels.
Yeah, they're just like doing social change and hanging out together. I'm sure Abigail has like a lot of trendy accessories on and, you know, they're living it out.
I love that.
That was great. Well, A.D. Bryant, everyone should check out Danger and Eggs. It's on Amazon Prime this Friday, June 30th. Thank you so much for coming in.
What
it was great
treat.
To chat with
Thank you.
Yeah, it was
guys.
Super fun. All right, we'll be back with more on EW Morning Live.
I was walking down the street the other day, trying to distract myself, but then I see your face. Oh wait, that's someone else, trying to play coy, trying to make it disappear. But just like the Battle of Troy, there's nothing subtle.
Welcome back to EW Morning Live. Dalton Ross here with you on Entertainment Weekly Radio, coming to you from Fiji, where I'm here for the filming of season 36. That is not a mistake. Season 36 of Survivor. It gets crazier every year when I say that. And I'm sitting here on the beach, off the beach of Fiji, with the challenge producer for all 36 of those seasons. Very good man. He's got a very good job. He does a very good job at it, Mr. John Kierhofer. What's going on, JK?
Hey, Dalton. Glad to be here.
Always great. We just tested out a challenge. So you do these challenges, and before you test them out multiple times, people running them, seeing, you know, you guys can see, is this the way we want it? Do we have our camera angle set up? Should we tweak or change anything? This challenge was so brutal that we did. And we can't describe it, because this isn't going to happen until next February. People are going to see it. But it was so brutal, so difficult. I've got scrapes, bumps, bruises everywhere. And I heard afterwards, you were talking to your boy Milhouse, who helps you out in the challenge department. And he said, oh, man, it's pretty rough. Should we tone it down a little bit? And you said, no, it's fine. I heard you say it.
Well, I love the Band-Aids that you got. You know, we have plenty of Band-Aids, so I don't think there's a problem. We've always said scrapes and abrasions are great. Bruises are great. Lacerations, contusions aren't great. So we walk a fine line, and so far we've been doing pretty good. I loved it today. Everybody was pretty beat up at the end, and it was just a good, big, physical and mental battle. It was perfect for me.
As all the Survivor ones are. So those that aren't familiar with the show, you and I have talked about this a lot, but if someone's sitting here listening on EW Radio and isn't hugely familiar with Survivor, they probably know about these challenges that you guys do. And as I just mentioned, people test them out. When the press is out here, we do that. But you have these people, the dream team, you call them. And they are people whose job it is to test out challenges. It's the best job in the world if you're like 21 years old. Go to these crazy countries and do these crazy challenges you come up with. And I want to talk to you to talk a little bit about how people get that job. But it's funny because last year when I was out here in Fiji, someone came up to me and said, you helped me get my job here. You put me in touch with John Kierhofer. It was incredible. I said, what a cool experience. That's great, man. Today, I'm walking around and someone comes up to me and goes, I just want to let you know, I was at EW Pop Fest because you were doing challenges there. And I went there and I stalked John Kierhofer and I told him I had a challenge idea and he hired me. And here I am because he met you at Entertainment Weekly's Pop Fest convention.
That's right. William Arbuckle. So we were doing the challenges at the Pop Fest, and this kid walks up. Hey, I'm a big fan of Survivor, and he goes on to explain a challenge. Can I pitch you a challenge? And he goes on and on. I go, I got to tell you the truth. Well, I have no idea what you just said. I got 10 things going on. Here's my card. Send me an email, and I'll give you my honest opinion. I'm not in the habit of stealing challenges, but if you have a great idea, I'd love to hear it. So he did the Photoshop and he worked up a nice sketch and a good write-up, and it was really good. It was a really great idea. So I said, hey, here's the deal, Will. Send me another one. Send me a few more pitches. And if you have one more that's as good as that, you know, maybe there's a job in it for you. Oh, so he's, and I said, and again, you know, for anybody listening, I don't just take ideas, and then use them for free. Sure enough, he sent a couple more that were solid. So I hired him as a consultant. He came into the office in January with me and Milhouse and my buddy Miles. And we started brainstorming. And two of the original puzzle ideas that he had, you will see in the first three, four episodes of Heroes, Healers, and Hustlers. So he's pretty darn proud. He's really good. I hired him on the dream team, and he's having the time of his life.
That's awesome. So let people know. So if someone's listening out there and they're thinking, oh, I want to get a job on the dream team, like, how do they go about it? I mean, people have done it through me and they get in touch with you, or they stalk you at Entertainment Weekly conventions, but how do you get most of your dream teamers?
Well, most are friends of friends or people on the crew, but since, I think, China, season 15, Jeff started doing behind the scenes. That was our first behind the scenes, so super fans will see it, and then they track us down. They track me down. I can't give out my email address. We have a group of about 21 young people that do the testing and rehearsing. And of those, I usually bring at least half back for a second year if they're exceptional and they're on a good track. So then I have, this year I think we had 70 other applications. Just like with the contestants, I asked for photos, a resume, and it used to be a 1 to 3 minute video. Now it's just, give me a 1 minute video. Because we had 70 videos, 70 people, and they're, so many of them were just great. And we, you know, picked the best. But quite honestly, if you're the son of a cameraman and your qualifications are as good as the kid from Kansas who I don't know, you'll probably give it to the son of the cameraman. I mean, is it nepotism? Absolutely. But nepotism works. So keep good in the family.
Well, it is a survivor family here, without a doubt. And you've been here, as I mentioned, all 36 seasons. How many of you are there now that have been here since the very beginning?
Four. There's myself, our co-executive producer, Jesse Jensen, and Jeff Probst, and Scott Duncan. Scott Duncan comes in for a couple weeks at the beginning of every season and shoots those beautiful openings that we see. He's a master cinematographer, and so it's the four of us that have been on location for every season.
I still feel like you four should do like a ceremonial toast or something the night before, like the kickoff every year.
Yeah, well, it's not as formatted, but we do every season get together and we at least get a ceremonial fist bump like we did yesterday morning on day one.
So we talked about the dream teamers, the people that test out the challenge. How do they do it? So, you know, how do they do in the challenge compared to the actual players? Because it's interesting because the actual players are, you know, have not been sleeping, have not been eating, they're cold, they're worn out, they're mentally exhausted, and the dream teamers are all, and they might be older, not as in shape. Well, the dream teamers are all very young, very fit, they're eating, they're sleeping, they're doing everything, yet they don't have the stakes that the players have.
Exactly, the caveat of $1 million, the caveat of being on television, you know, having the accountability of the rest of their tribe. You never, you know, we test everything, and it gives us a good gauge. So when we test a puzzle, and we say it averaged about 6 minutes. It averaged, but the individual, like our 6 minute puzzle, it was literally 6 minutes for that opening puzzle that we did, and outside was 22 minutes. Somebody did it in 2.5 minutes. So you never know what you're going to get when one of the super fans, kind of like David. From Millennials Gen X, met him and said, I have a 3D printer and I've printed out the puzzles that you guys have done. It's like, holy mackerel. So now David was ready for puzzles. Some people practice making fire, some don't. Dream Team, they're super fit, but sometimes they get worn down. They're working 6 days a week from early morning until the evening, and sometimes they just don't have the fire in their bellies. So, you know, you never know.
So when you time it out, on average, would you say that they are about average, the players and the dream teamers, or dream teamers usually beat them a little bit, or what?
I would say it's a pretty good gauge, but it all depends. Remember when we were in the Amazon? I know now I'm going way back.
I love it.
We used to test endurance challenges. I don't even bother anymore. We don't have the 12-hour challenges, the dance challenges anymore. We have, you will stand here, you know, as long as you can. But after an hour, if you're still standing there, you'll stand on one foot.
Right.
You know, we're not, we don't need to be there for 12 hours anymore. But we tested these endurance challenges, see how long they can go. Mark Burnett would say, John, give an extra $300. Okay. All right, guys, for $300, how long can you stand there with your hand on the post? And we did the one in Amazon where they had to hold like a crown over their head on a post.
And final challenge, right?
Yeah, final challenge. Rob Cesternino and Jenna Maraska. Matt. I love Matt, actually. I was pulling for Matt. The Dream Team went like 3.5 hours. And they went 12 minutes, I think. And then Baba Booey, we did this thing where they bobbed on a buoy in season 10. Tom Westman won. And
where Ian famously quit.
Ian famously stepped down. Right. Katie stepped down earlier.
Right.
I think she had to go to the bathroom or something.
Yeah.
The Dream Team went 3 or 4 hours. I said, oh, okay, the most it's going to go is a few hours. I was on that thing for 20 minutes. I said, okay, this is never going to go very long. And they went 12 hours into the night, famously did tribal council out in the lagoon, had to bring in lights and fire. So, you know, it's we just never gauge endurance challenges anymore. We just know they'll end. I always tell the camera guys, bring lots of tape.
I'm talking to John Kierhofer in Fiji. They are filming Survivor season 36. He is the challenge producer. He comes out with all those awesome competitions you see on the show. And it's funny you mentioned those old endurance competitions. I was going to ask you about that. You guys have had some final challenges that have just been like epic, huge builds, giant things. They look incredible. But I've told you this before, I do miss the last challenge being that endurance challenge. Like you mentioned a few of them, there's also Thailand when they had to hold the coins in the hands. Like, there's something about that to me that is just, who wants it more, right? It gets down to that. And it's interesting here you're talking about, we can't do these 12-hour things anymore, but I do miss that. Would you ever consider even a season one? Simple, put your hand on the post. Who keeps it there the longest? There's something about that I do miss that I really liked.
Yeah, no, there's something special about them also, because when you're watching, you're getting the same 8-12 minutes of television, but there's the time lapse, and there goes into darkness, and all those things. We've been out here for 36 seasons, and it just feels like we've evolved from being out there, keeping the crew out there forever when they're running into overtime and all those other things that we didn't account for. So I love when a challenge goes a few hours. You know, we do Get a Grip. Where they get up on the post, that's a classic. When it rains, it pours, and they have their hand over, and they drop the bucket of water. We still do that every once in a while. That's 3 or 4 hours. We're fine with 3 or 4 hours, but the company kind of frowns on is we're supposed to have tribal council. We have rehearsals. People are on. The behind the scenes thing is, you know, it's we just don't need to be out there for that long.
Speaking of being in a place for a long time, you are in Fiji again, as we mentioned. This is the first time Survivor has ever filmed 4 seasons straight in the same location. What is it from a challenge department perspective that Fiji gives you that maybe some of the other locations don't?
In my world, I'd say, I'm always looking to go someplace new, and even if it doesn't offer as much, just for my own personal adventure. But when there was a decision to stay, I was like, well, if I got to stay somewhere twice, this is my favorite location perhaps ever since Kenya. But even Kenya, we don't have the beautiful water. But I got to say, we have beautiful lagoons. We have water to land areas. We have the atoll, which is this coral reef structure out in the middle of the ocean. And, you know, where it's hundreds of feet deep, but we got this little coral structure that's a perfect 30 feet deep. We can set up our towers, we set up our water challenges, and have crystal blue underwater shots, the dive down shots. We have big fields that are perfect for our big aggressive physical challenges and our big mazes. So for us, and the weather, we get just enough rain. We get, like last year we had the hurricane. But overall, it's that beautiful tropical paradise, and I love it here. I love every minute here.
You try and plan everything out when you're mapping out a challenge in terms of the way it can be done. You might set limits for contestants on what they can and can't do in a challenge, but you you try and figure out how are they going to run it. Let's mimic it and set it up a certain way. Occasionally, they outsmart you, maybe, though. Occasionally they figure out another way to do it you haven't anticipated. How often does that happen?
I'm trying to think off the top of my head when that... I know it has happened.
First challenge in Nicaragua. It happened with the shoots. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was just... Oh, I hated that. The challenge itself wasn't all that exciting. It was old versus young.
Yeah.
So my awesome boss, Mark, loved the idea of it. And so we had to come up with challenges that were fair for the different age groups, for the old people versus the young people. So it couldn't be big head-to-head physical battles. And so we tried to keep it fair, and which kind of softened what we could do. We definitely couldn't do what we did today with you guys, that's for sure. And not only was it started off as a soft challenge, but then they just, we had this thing go from left to right, right to left.
There were chutes that they would hold zigzag down. But
chutes of water, big empty chutes that they would go, they would pour water from the top to the bottom, and they just went straight down. And
as soon as they did that, what went through your mind?
Basically crap. And once they filled up enough water, dropped puzzle pieces, and they raised into the puzzle. And that sucked. And so we learned. And basically, I'll wear it. We should have been much, much more clear and with our rules on how it had to unfold. And I guess we didn't give the parameters. The other thing about the challenge, not to try to defend myself on all levels, every once in a while things don't go right, because unlike football or baseball, where you've got hundreds of years or dozens of years or whatever established and you tweak the rules and you get it all polished, we try new things. So we try this new, like basketball, out in the water.
Right.
We got all the rules pretty well down. The first time, we had figuring it out. A lot of our challenges that we do, classics that we do for a second or third time, we figure out and we learn from our mistakes. And a lot of them we're running for the first time and we go, oh, dang, didn't see that happening. Didn't see that coming, but it won't happen next time. So there is that learning curve.
I've been out on location 15 times now here, and I've seen once or twice when you've had to, when a player has done something against the rules. Mm-hmm. How often does that happen? When someone does something, maybe tries to go and sabotage the other team, or they go into an area they're not supposed to go to yet, or something. How often do you have to stop people, hold them, maybe give them a 10-second penalty, anything like that?
Not that often. Not that often, because most play pretty nice. Occasionally we'll get a rogue or a returning player who has more comfort with us. A lot of the newer players, they see Jeff and they're awestruck. And the thing about having Jeff, I've worked on a lot of different shows and several different game shows. Jeff owns everything. I've worked on so many shows where the host will come in and say, okay, so what's going on here? What are the beats? Okay, they run out here, they collect this, they do that. Okay, have my cards ready or whatever. Jeff is our boss. Jeff's the executive producer. First he approves the concept. Then we test and we check in with him. How'd this test go? How'd that test go? Then when he's here on location, we test again with the dream team. Then you're out there. He knows it. He knows it inside and out. So Milhouse and myself and AB, we're on the sidelines as judges, and we're just there to be the eyes that he can't see, where he can't see things. Jeff, this, and usually we're each looking for one or two things. And so if he sees my hand go up, it means they didn't touch this or they didn't grab that. And he can just say, hey, go back. He doesn't have to see it. He knows that we're not gonna call something and we tell the contestants right up front, if we have to yell from the sideline, we're trying to help you. We're not looking to trick you. We're not looking to hamstring anybody. It's just, we know you got a lot of things going through your mind. We want you to make sure you hit all the beats, A, B, C, and D.
In the right order.
Yeah. But Jeff, he owns it all from beginning to end. So he is not afraid, as you've seen, to let people know if they're off course and they're doing something wrong.
Talking with John Kierhofer, who designs all the challenges you see on Survivor, huge builds, tons of fun. And John, I've been known to say in my recaps, wow, look at this incredible challenge, and they're doing this all this huge physical stuff and this and that, but it's really all about the puzzle. How accurate is that when I say that the puzzle is always the most important phase in a challenge?
Well,
In terms of winning.
If I can quote you.
Yes.
Because I do read you. It's all just window dressing for a puzzle, which, fair enough. Yeah. You know, I mean, we're putting these big physical elements in front of something, you know, that'll take 3 minutes to get through the physical thing, and then you got a 20-minute puzzle. It's about the 20-minute puzzle. But you can't just start off with a 20-minute puzzle. You've got people with different skill sets, and we're going to make you earn the advantage of getting there first. And if the people, the thinking people, the puzzle solvers, if they come short, we've had so many puzzles finish moments before the other puzzle, and thank God that tribe was able to get up and over the net or crawl under the sand quicker than the other tribe so that they have the advantage.
Is it fun, you know, you see all these in the season, the beginning of the season, teams saying like, oh, we got to keep the strong guys, we keep the strong guys. How come I never hear tribes saying, we got to keep the smart guys, we got to keep the smart people? Because it seems like that's really much more important. I remember being out here for, I guess it was All Stars, or maybe Heroes Villains, one of the Boston Rob seasons. Right. And you know, we talked as the press before the first challenge, we're talking with Jeff Probst, like, oh, who do you think is going to win this challenge? And at first, Boston Rob was on the physical part. So we're like, oh, the other tribe. And Jeff's like, they're making a mistake. He should be on the puzzle. Then at the last second, Boston Rob went on the puzzle, and he motioned to us, look, and then, of course, they won. So how come, does it ever... Are people playing the game incorrectly, talking about keeping the strong people instead of the smart people for the puzzles or not?
You know, you definitely hear that more. Keep the strong. And because if you don't get to the puzzle, you have no chance of winning the puzzle.
Right.
That's true. But we've also seen in Game Changers, big physical threat gone, big physical threat gone, big physical threat gone, big physical threat gone. So, you know, sometimes you need to keep the strong. David was a great one. He would tell them, you need somebody who can do the puzzle. He wasn't that great at puzzles, though.
Right, but
he let them know, you need me around for that. Yeah, you need us around for that. You know, you always have somebody in that's good at the puzzle. And when people say, how do you get rid of, what should you do to prepare for Survivor? A lot of people come in, they go, you know, I've been practicing making fire. That's a great idea. You should practice making fire. But you should go to Toys R Us or whatever and get every puzzle you can and play every puzzle in a newspaper, because puzzles are puzzles and it's a way of thinking, you know? So if you come out, so many people come out completely unprepared and it boggles my mind. But you're absolutely right. If you have people who are good on puzzles, they can keep you in at the end.
I remember Zeke saying, I think it was Sandra that told him, I'm not sure, about an app that was a slide puzzle app that they practiced
before
they came out. And that's probably a smart thing to do. John, it's season 36, as we mentioned, that you just started filming. Day one was yesterday of filming. How much longer do you want to do this? How much longer can the show keep going on?
You know, Mark Burnett and Charlie Parsons, you know, years ago when they came up with this, Charlie Parsons came up with the original, Mark turned it into the phenomenon. I really believe they created the next football, baseball, basketball. It's a format that keeps changing. There's a whole new group of people. It's got a new audience. I think it can go on. I hope it goes on for years and years and years and years, and I hope I'm here for most of them.
We'll be doing it from the Survivor old age home together. We'll still be talking about it.
If you had told me 18 years ago that I would still be doing it, I remember one of my most fond memories or vivid memories, season one, I got on a boat, and we worked 7 days a week, morning to night, through the night, creating things. And I was the guy out there on the scuba gear setting the moorings and the buoys and stuff. And I got on that boat as I was leaving, and I went, oh my God, I hope it does okay. I hope I get to do another one. One more. Africa would be cool. Australia. Maybe Fiji. I remember mentioning Fiji and Tahiti. Oh, that would be awesome. I would, you know, and now a couple passports later, it's been a dream. It still is. I'm incredibly, incredibly blessed.
All right, John Kierhofer, challenge producer for Survivor. We are coming to you from Fiji, dude. Always great to hang out. I'm going to go tend to my wounds now from the challenge you put me through today, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks, man.
All right, Dalton. Always a pleasure.
All right, we'll be back with more on EW Morning Live.
For more TV and movie interviews sent right to you, subscribe to the EW Morning Live podcast on iTunes. And to get 24-hour entertainment news and views, check out Entertainment Weekly Radio at channel 105 on Sirius XM.